Logan's Market, an internationally recognized leader in top quality products. When I pointed out to him that his last suggestion might be taking it a bit too far, he responded with one of his twists of logic. Where are you from, he asked me. Ethiopia. And what about me? Zaire, Congo. Take your pick, I said. Well then, that settles it. If you ask me who has the best products, I will tell you, Logan's Market. I am international and so are you. That means the store is internationally recognized.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, Dino Mengestu reads from The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears. Mengestu's award-winning debut novel follows an Ethiopian immigrant who runs a failing convenience store in Washington, D.C. His love affair with a gentrifying neighbor unfolds in counterpoint to his stark memories of fleeing his country's communist revolution. Dino Mengestu is too young to remember Ethiopia's Red Terror. He left the country as a toddler, and now he's in his early 30s. As a reporter, Mengestu has covered strife in Uganda and Darfur for magazines like Harper's and Rolling Stone. This reading of The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears was recorded in February of 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you all so much for coming out. It's a pleasure to be here. Maybe I'll quickly describe the novel, since maybe you don't know about it, maybe you do, and I'll just bore you with it anyway. But it's narrated by an Ethiopian immigrant named Seyfo Stefanos, who moves to Washington, D.C. after leaving the communist revolution in Ethiopia in the 1970s, and he owns a small grocery store in Logan Circle. And the other trick about reading in D.C. is so many people know Logan Circle, and they say, that's not the way it actually looks. The buildings don't look like that, but it's his version of Logan Circle as he sees it and as I see it in my imagination. And he has a small little grocery store with two other friends, Joseph from the Congo and Kenneth from Kenya. And the three of them form a little surrogate family of immigrants and who all spend their time kind of reflecting back on Africa's history of coups and dictators and the neighborhood that Seyfo lives in. As many of you probably know, is in the middle of gentrifying pretty rapidly, and he's about to lose his store, and that kind of causes him to flee one day and set off on a long, ambling, wandering tour of Washington, D.C., where he gets a chance to think about all of the great things in Washington, D.C. So this scene that I'm going to read is just shortly after he's left his store, and he's been wandering the city for most of the afternoon, and he goes to visit his uncle's apartment in Silver Spring, and he's just kind of remembering how his life in America first began and how he sort of got to be where he is after 17 years. When I first came to this apartment, my uncle sat me down on the couch in the living room and proceeded to lecture me about what I could expect to find now that I was in America. Everything that is in this apartment, he said, belongs to you as much as it does to me. Outside of this apartment, though, you have nothing. Nothing is yours. Nothing belongs to you. Take nothing for granted. No one here will give you anything for free. There's no such thing as that in America. People only give you something because they think they will get something in return. I remember there's absolutely no passion or conviction to his words. He seemed to be reading them off an invisible monitor lying just before his eyes, aimed toward the ground as they were. I don't know if he saw in me a flicker of ambition or desire, but he need not have worried. I didn't want anything from America. In those days, I believed it was only a matter of weeks or months before I returned home to Ethiopia. I spent all my energy and free time planning for that. How was I supposed to live in America when I'd never really left Ethiopia? I wasn't, I decided. I wasn't supposed to live here at all. I nodded my head obediently as he spoke and pitied him for not understanding just how temporary all of this was. For the first 3 weeks I was here in this apartment, I didn't speak to a single person besides my uncle, and even then our conversations were brief and strained. I rarely left the apartment, nor did I want to. Any connection, whether it was to a person, building, or time of day, would have been deceitful, and so I avoided making eye contact with people I didn't know and tried to deny myself even the simplest of pleasures. I refused to acknowledge the charm of a sunset or the pleasure of a summer afternoon. If possible, I would have denied myself the right to breathe another country's air or walk on its ground. My uncle and I lived off that divide that separated our life in this apartment from everything that occurred outside of it. I ate his food. I slept on his couch. For 2 months, this was all I did. At the end of the second month, he came into the living room while I was getting ready to sleep and said in that always whispering voice of his, "Baka." I knew what he meant immediately. Enough. And he was right. It had been enough. No one but he would have said it so gently or granted me so much license. I nodded my head in agreement. I was ashamed of myself and would have done anything he asked me to. "Come with me to work tomorrow and I'll try to find you a job," he said. That was how my life in America started. It seems a shame we don't know these things at the time. My first day of work at the Capitol Hotel, I was escorted by my uncle to the manager's office. My uncle introduced me as his nephew, Sefa Stefanos, although he told the manager he could call me Sefa, or even Stephen for short if he found that more convenient. The two men discussed my background while I stood there mute. The manager, a solid, squat, bald man whom I had been told to refer to only as Sir, didn't believe that I could speak English. He pointed to my skinny arms and asked my uncle if I had any problems lifting heavy objects, if I had any objections to working late-night shifts, if I could be trusted, in general, not to steal from the hotel or its clients. "No, sir," my uncle replied for me. "He has no problems, perfectly honest. He has no objections to anything." The manager decided that I should begin that day so that he could see what I was made of. He squeezed my right bicep once for good measure, and then held out his hand for me to shake. I remember wishing I had the courage and strength to crush every bone in his hand. After we walked out of the office, I heard my uncle mumble under his breath just loud enough so only I could hear, "Bastard." Yes, it was a show of pride, half-hearted but necessary nonetheless. It was one thing for him to sir his way through the day on his own, and an entirely different matter to have me there as a witness to it. We rode the train back to Maryland together. We spoke as little as possible until we reached the apartment. When we reached home, I went to ask him if this was worth it. This one-bedroom apartment in a dilapidated building on the edges of a city. Our rent was only several hundred dollars a month, but look at what it took to earn that money. My uncle turned himself off every morning the moment he left the apartment for work. He didn't turn himself back on until 10 or 12 hours later when he returned home. Nothing was the right word for the way he lived, and so was the vacancy with which he had said it. I worked at the job my uncle found for me, and later on I attended the school he had picked. I hardly remember making any decisions of my own until one night, 3 years later, when I realized I couldn't continue living like this any longer. The choice became clear to me as I walked alone along the banks of the Potomac after working two shifts at the hotel. My arms and legs were numb from 13 hours of lifting luggage and bending at every moment to someone else's need. It was too late at night to be walking alone along the empty riverbank, but there was nothing at that point that I cared for or worried about losing. Life could come or go, and it wouldn't have made a difference. I walked miles that night, under the willow trees that had just begun to bloom. Lincoln's and Jefferson's memorials stood to my right, casting a distant pale glow over the river. I followed the Potomac to the Memorial Bridge and stood in the center, D.C. to one side, Virginia to the other. I leaned my body over the edge and stared down into the water, wondering what, if anything, I had to live for. I couldn't believe that my father had died and I had been spared in order to carry luggage in and out of a room. There was nothing special to death anymore. I'd seen enough lifeless bodies by that point to know that. I thought long and hard about what it would be like to simply step off the edge. I didn't know how to swim, nor would I have tried. The next day, I quit my job at the Capitol Hotel. I left my uncle's apartment less than a year later. They were the first real decisions I had made on my own since coming to this country. I loved them. Their impracticality made me love them even more. When I first told Joseph and Kenneth that I was leaving the hotel, they looked at me dumbstruck for a few minutes until Joseph finally leaned over and smacked my hand high in the air. "You see, Stefanos, I always knew you had more in you. Soon we will all leave this place, and next time we come back, they will be carrying our luggage up the stairs." Finding an apartment in Logan Circle was easy enough at the time. There was a for rent sign in just about every building I passed. As for the store, that had been Kenneth's idea. be your own boss, man. That's the only way to get anywhere in this country. And so with Kenneth's help, I got a small business loan from the government. I opened my store in its space that had once been a liquor store. As far as I know, it was the first liquor store in the neighborhood to have gone out of business. Kenneth taught me how to keep track of my accounts, make lists, order supplies and goods, and balance my budget. I used to think he would have made an exceptional father, patient as he always was with me, and who knows, perhaps someday he will. In the meantime, those fatherly instincts of his have led him to countless hours of tedious arithmetic, most of which I failed to learn properly. Joseph, for his part, came up with the name, Logan's Market. I've never heard anyone but him refer to it as such. For the store opening, he insisted on designing leaflets to pass around the neighborhood. Logan's Market, a new community store to serve all of your needs, carrying freshly stocked produce, canned goods, and general household needs at great prices. In his usual fashion, he toiled over those two sentences for an entire afternoon in my apartment. "What do you think about this, Stefanos?" he asked. "Logan's Market, a leader in top-quality produce. Or better yet, Logan's Market, serving you and your family with only the freshest ingredients for the best prices." His ideas only grew larger as he spoke. "Logan's Market, an internationally recognized leader in top-quality products." It's the first time anybody's laughed at my readings. Finally. When I pointed out to him that his last suggestion might be taking it a bit too far, he responded with one of his twists of logic. "Where are you from?" he asked me. "Ethiopia." "And what about me? Where am I from? "Zaire, Congo." "Take your pick," I said. "Well then, that settles it. If you ask me who has the best products, I will tell you Logan's Market." "I am international and so are you. That means the store is internationally recognized." "It's all about marketing," he said. "You have to learn and think now like a businessman." I let him scribble away in my apartment until he settled on something that matched the eloquence he knew he was capable of. By the time the store opened, Joseph and Kenneth had put as much energy and thought into it as I had. Kenneth was waiting for me in front of the store with a bottle of champagne the morning I opened. "Don't you have work?" I asked him. "I took the day off," he said. "I wanted to be here for this." We drank the bottle later that evening once Joseph got off work. "This is the beginning," Joseph said. "Today, right here, with Stefanos' store, we begin new lives. No more of this bullshit, right?" We were all guilty of hyperinflated optimism and irrational hope at that point, but how could we not have been? You should have seen us then. Joseph was right. You wouldn't have believed your eyes. We were young and we were skinny and in our eyes beautiful. Joseph and Kenneth were both still working at the Capitol Hotel as waiters in the hotel's main restaurant, and the opening of my store, our store, as we referred to it that night, was supposed to signal departure from frustrating, underpaying jobs and unrealized ambitions. As that first night in the store wore on, our conversations grew increasingly grand, our ambitions and desires for the world limited only by imagination. You know, Stefanos, together we could be onto something." That's Kenneth speaking now. He's raising his glass in the air as if he's about to toast the sky, leaning back in his chair with the same repose that I've now come to know as intimately as my own gestures. In his own particular way, he could be just as hyperbolic in his speech as Joseph, even if he has a hard time accepting it. Now, when he speaks, it's always with an overly deliberate reserve and skepticism. He says it's because he's an engineer, but I know that's not it. I spent 2 months living in his oversized, barely furnished apartment when the heat in mine broke during the middle of a winter storm 3 years ago. I tried not to be around when he came home from work. I couldn't bear the sight of him sitting frozen and lifeless in a plastic lawn chair by the patio windows, drinking beer after beer, wiggling his toes in his expensive wool socks. I came home one night and found him laughing hysterically to himself. The only light in the apartment came from the street lamp that hung just a few feet away from the porch's windows. It wasn't enough light to see him by, which was fine because I could hear him laughing and arguing with himself, and I wouldn't have wanted to know what his face looked like while he was doing that. All of this would come about years later, of course, leaving that first night in the store to sit and burn in my memory. I mean, if we look at this store as the first step to an even greater venture, this neighborhood has potential, man. I tell you, we should begin thinking about expanding. In a year or two, you could have an entire grocery store. Start your own franchise. Kenneth sketched out some numbers on the back of a notebook. What did the numbers mean? Nothing, but they were nice to look at. Joseph laid out his plan that night for getting his college degree and then his PhD from the University of Michigan. It's all very simple, he said. I have talent, and top universities need talent. When they see what I can do, they will beg me to come. I'm certain of it. And why Michigan? Kenneth asked him. Joseph scratched the bottom of his chin. Because it's a top-notch school. I knew a woman who went there once. She was a teacher. Smartest woman I ever met. She told me I was brilliant. Joseph, she said, you're one of the smartest men I have ever met. She told me I should go there someday, and that is what I'm going to do. Kenneth, for his part, was going to get his engineering degree and then a master's. Only then, he said, will I go back to Africa. I will go to Nairobi in the finest suits, and everyone will say, look at him. That is someone important. That is someone special. I'll build them buildings that will blow them away. No one will have seen anything like them. As for me, I was going to sit in my high back chair behind a counter and read as silent as a god until the world came to an end. Thank you. And anyway, the best part of this is always, of course, if you do have questions, because that makes it more exciting and interesting for me and for you. So if you have questions, I'd love to answer them. Can I say a little bit of my own background? I was born in Ethiopia in 1978 and left 2 years later. Grew up in Peoria, Illinois for several years and then Chicago. So contrary to some people's thought, I'm not a D.C. native. And then went to Georgetown. And this is all sort of, I feel like I'm... And then I went to Columbia and then New York, and then I wrote a book and got here. The short version of the story. A few things happened in between, but none of them that interesting.
Why did you decide to base the book in Washington, D.C.?
I started writing the book when I was back in D.C. visiting. And I sort of always had a kind of love of D.C. I started coming here at a pretty young age because I did have an uncle who was living here, so I would spend my summers with him. And that was kind of when I first sort of saw the city, and it just kind of always struck me as a city full of like vast and strange discrepancies. And when I came back at Georgetown, I didn't stay near Georgetown. I kind of wanted to actually live in the city while I was here, and I grew sort of pretty attached to D.C. And then one night I was walking down a street in, I think, 18th Street, and I saw an Ethiopian immigrant behind the counter of a small little grocery store, and the voice of the narrator kind of popped into my head. And then as I started writing it, I really wanted it to be about D.C., and Logan Circle was like the first neighborhood that I actually knew when I came to D.C., and watching Logan Circle kind of do that sort of stunning and massive change over such a short period of time was compelling, so compelling that it kind of like stayed with me 10 years after it was over.
I think you just answered part of my question. I'm in the middle of your wonderful book. And just through acquaintances in D.C. of shop owners, this could be written about so many people, whether they're from Ethiopia or India or Sri Lanka. Did you spend time with folks? I mean, how did you get inside this guy's head? Because it's really kind of clear that you did that.
I didn't sort of deliberately sort of go off and research anything while I was writing the book. I mean, I think if you sort of, you know, obviously I come from a family of immigrants, and I think if you sort of pay attention to the environments around you, you get a sense of who these people are. Also, I think the character is kind of driven by this like search for a kind of home, and that I think is a pretty kind of common thing. I don't think that's necessarily unique or particular to immigrants. I think it's something most people generally feel at one point in time in their lives is, how do you actually kind of create a life? How do you feel adjusted to the place that you're supposed to be in and to the place that's supposed to be your home? And that was probably, I think, what made the character so kind of come to life for me, much more so than having to listen to other people or having to sort of interview anybody else. It was just, I think, you know, what I think is pretty universal and pretty common feeling.
Do you see a sort of wave of people going back to their home countries? Do you feel that there's a widespread sense of disappointment or disillusionment? Would you go back?
I have been back. It's hard to sort of speak in sort of terms of like people as a whole. I think there's always something hard to going back. So I think obviously there is a sort of discrepancy that between the expectations that you have before you sort of arrive, whether it's in America or any sort of country that you're emigrating to. There's a certain perception of the West, especially, that things are sort of going to automatically materialize very quickly and rapidly, and everything is going to, you know, you'll find your job, your school, everything will sort of work itself out, and it doesn't work out that way. But returning also, I think, is a much more complicated thing than people sort of give it credit for. It's returning not only to your sort of past, but with a sort of whole other world of burdens from the life that you've created here and trying to kind of get the two to fit together. So it's impossible for me to generalize whether or not any one group is returning back more so than the other. I think people miss their homes a lot. Whether or not they return back to them doesn't mean they miss them any less, though.
Hi there. I loved your book. And last year, and I think late 2006, there were a couple of other books that were published also by young men about the refugee experience in the United States. I'm thinking of Egger's book on what is called What is the What? About the Sudanese refugee, as well as Ishmael Bea's book about A Long Way Gone. And I'm just wondering if why you think these books are being published now. Is this coincidence? Has your book been talked about in the same breath as these books? And sort of what overarching message do you want this book? And I mean, I think all these books that I mentioned are sort of telling the same thing. It's about identity and place. But you know, what do you want the takeaway to be from your book too?
You're right. There was this sort of a. It seems like a sudden onslaught, but like you said, it's actually just three books. But everyone's like, oh my, well, there were more. That's true. But there were, like, you know, there's also Chimamanda's book. I mean, there's actually Beast of No Nations. And then, you know, sort of Vanity Fair had their sort of Africa issue, which meant suddenly Africa was really, really popular, which also means that Africa is no longer going to be popular. It's like when everybody wears the same pairs of shoes, you know, you probably don't have to go out and buy them. And that's a sort of, I think, you know, it's a certain media perception which is created around it that suddenly there is this sort of large flux of books. I think a lot of books have been written about Africa and by Africans for quite a while. Suddenly finding, you know, at the best, if I named a half dozen, that's not necessarily exceptional. It's just that suddenly, you know, one Dave Eggers sort of got by to his book, which was a sort of very fine and very good book. And Ishmael's book came out right around the same time as well. And, you know, that does, I think, sort of, there was a certain kind of concern for Africa that happened in the media, which kind of brought those books to a lot of attention, which is great. It's also sort of strange, I think, in a certain way, because it makes it seem more like it's a phenomenon, which I don't want it to seem like, because phenomenons sort of come and go. I think it should sort of be seen as like a general thing of writers writing to the point that, you know, there should be a sort of comfortable place for African literature, for Africans writing about Africa in the same strain and vein that there is for French writers writing or Indian writers, South Asian writers writing. It shouldn't kind of stand out as this sort of exceptional phase, which it still sort of does. I think that'll sort of pass eventually, probably pretty soon. And, you know, Ishmael and I did a reading together, and Dave Eggers is sort of always kind of hovering in the shadows because you can't get away from Dave Eggers. As for the message, I don't think of the book as having a message. If it had a message, I probably just would have written it at the beginning and then probably wouldn't have finished writing the book. I can't possibly think of the book as having a message. It's just sort of, you know, everything that you've tried to say for your whole life kind of comes out in it.
Danielle, this is your first novel, and you've obviously struck a chord with readers and critics and juries. And can you talk a little bit about what it was like just your education as a novelist, and were there some wrong turns and that you had to write, and what did you learn about the craft of novel writing?
I have one of my old teachers here, so she could probably tell you that. When I, you know, it's sort of an ongoing thing. Before this book, I wrote another very, very bad book that I started when I was at Georgetown in Professor Tilden's class over there, although I don't think she ever read it. and that's actually, I think, where you learn the most about writing is that process of spending 3 to 4 years writing a book and watching it not materialize in the way you kind of expect it to, and then realizing you have to kind of start again and do it with something else. And, you know, it's anything that kind of happens with a book is nice, but it's all pretty ephemeral, I think, in the end. It's if the book is going to be good, it'll sort of outlast anything that anybody says or gives it. So that's kind of the more interesting thing about the sort of work, is that when you're looking towards the next book, I think before this one, as soon as this one was sort of over, I was kind of waiting to see what I could write next. And that kind of makes everything else that happens with this sort of recede pretty quickly into the background. And you realize that's sort of, you know, there's so many great books published in a single year, much better. And you can't sort of worry too much about anyone after it's done. It's done. It's out of your hands.
When I read through your book, which was marvelous the first time, I came to sort of get to know these two buildings, this doomed house and this doomed store. And they seemed to me like characters. And I wondered, did you have that sort of relationship with them, or how did you feel about them as you wrote about them?
I did. I was pretty attached, actually. I mean, I sort of pretty attached to, like, the architecture of most of both D.C. and the community and the neighborhood. Like, the sort of landscape in which the book is set became sort of fairly central to the characters and to myself. Logan Circle, when one of the houses that sort of gets destroyed, was kind of slightly modeled on a house that I used to know in Logan Circle, which I used to spend a lot of time just kind of marveling over because it was a wreck. I'm sure many of you might know it's the big white mansion on Logan Circle. I think it's Logan Circle 1 and 2 or Logan Circle 2 and 3, which used to be a sort of very dilapidated building that we used to call the Scooby-Doo Mansion. And I was kind of always compelled by it, and then watching it sort of change became sort of emblematic of just kind of how significant the change inside of the entire community was. The building sort of played a pretty central role in my imagination.
I was going to say, what inspired you to write in the beginning? Did you always think of writing, or what was your main motivation that got you to start writing?
Other books.
Books. Are there any specific?
There would be tons and dozens. But I think what you sort of find is, this that I found at a pretty young age is that I sort of felt very comfortable in books. I loved reading to the point where you sort of exist more in the imagination of a novel than you kind of do in the real world sometimes. And I also learned that I kind of really love language, and that there's like the writers who I sort of admired were the ones who could, you know, kind of distill an entire lifetime of thought into a few sentences. And that always made me think that'd be really a great thing to try and do sometime.
Go ahead.
I'll stop there.
How old were you when you came here?
Two.
Two. Oh, okay. Yeah. How long did it take you to finish the book?
I would say it took about two and a half years to sort of finish writing it. But, I started the book. I was working lots of different jobs. So I had to stop writing for 6-7 months. And then I would go back to writing when I could take time off, or I would basically quit jobs, get credit cards. So it sort of just not the sort of example that you would want to set for anybody. So, you know, overall, it did take about 2 years, but with some large gaps in between. But even in the gaps, you kind of spend the gaps thinking about what you wish you were sort of doing. And then the editing process took a few more months. So
I have two questions, and they're sort of quick. But one is, like, is there a reason why you chose a grocery store and not something else? And the other one is if you have already another book in mind, and if you could share with us what it is, like its general idea.
The grocery store, I don't know. it was because I think that was the sort of image. For me, what I have written before in the past, the novels tend to sort of begin with an image or a particular sentence. And this book began with a very particular sentence about somebody wondering why nobody comes into the store anymore. And once that sentence was sort of there, that kind of determined the character's voice and the entire setting. So I couldn't get away from having it in a grocery store. If I wanted to put it into a bookstore, it wouldn't have worked, I think, at that point. As for the, I am working on a second book, but I don't talk about it.
As I was reading through the book, I started to get very frustrated with the narrator, for I felt like he just gave up hope, and I wanted to kind of shake him and say, "What? You know, why are you doing this? How did you feel about the end? Did you feel like he gave up hope? How did you feel about that?"
It's tricky, because then I tend not to want to say exactly how I feel about the ending, because I don't want to skew any readers' perspectives. But I mean, I guess I'm going to anyway. So it's, I actually feel generally pretty optimistic about the book. I think, and about the sort of where the narrator ends up. There's a very different perception. It's interesting watching people respond to it, because I've had talking to some college students recently, and you know, one girl in particular was just like, "Dude, why doesn't he just get a job?" which is kind of understandable, and people sort of express that frustration. And then in other places, people sort of completely understand that kind of that sense of having removed himself so far out of life that that's not something that matters anymore. The idea of the sort of performance that you can make in terms of having a sort of career and a stable life actually doesn't amount to that much if you don't actually feel like you're at home, or if you don't feel like you're attached to things, if you don't feel like you've actually, that you're in a place that you want to be in. And if you're sort of carrying this ghost of the past, then you can have, you know, a dozen jobs and you can have the biggest car in the world, but that doesn't actually give you any more sense of place in the world. Mm-hmm. And so from the narrator, I always sort of understood why he wasn't going to get up and do anything else, because the getting up involved being able to sort of engage in a way that he tries to do in the novel but then doesn't actually succeed, which is why I think when the book does end, though, he comes to sort of understand what he needs. Thank you, Alison, very much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour. Thank you.